this series of studies on the philosophy of history. And as we have carried it under the title of the Cycle of the Phoenix, we should reiterate that this cycle of 600 years, originating in antiquity, seems to supply an admirable framework for a study of the great periods in the historical descent of man. Last week, we analyzed the period beginning with the 12th century and extending through the Reformation, the Renaissance, and the dawn of the modern world, particularly the great era of exploration. We pointed out also that although history seems to build to very critical cycles, actually history is a flowing of cause and effect, and each crisis that arises in the development of the historical perspective is the natural outcome of antecedent causes. Therefore, we realize that when we choose an arbitrary date, we are not choosing a beginning, but rather are choosing a point of crisis where various factors, long established, have been welded together into a kind of pattern that suddenly emerges and profoundly affects the destiny of human beings. Our next cycle of the Phoenix, therefore, passes from the year 1200 for approximately 600 year interval and brings us to approximately the year 1800. This year ushered in the 19th century, and this century is rather close to us, and perhaps we consider ourselves well informed as to the occurrences which have marked it. At the same time, in our thinking, there are points that well may have been overlooked. We like to think of this period, beginning about the year 1800, as the era of liberation. Here we find a tremendous emphasis upon the emergence of man, of the increasing influence of the human being as an equation in the motions of society. There is a gradual shift from minority rulership to the rulership by masses, by groups. Also, a corresponding decrease in the individualization of the person, a decrease which has reached rather startling proportions in this, the middle of our 20th century. Gradually, the emphasis in history also changed. The historian became a new kind of person, and at approximately the period we note, about the year 1800, we observe a subtle modification occurring in man's relation to historical perspective. This modification had to do with the establishment of ancient history upon a scientific basis. As you probably realize, up to about this time, man's knowledge of history outside of contemporary affairs was extremely sketchy. The 18th century historian, writing, for example, about Egypt, was without benefit of the Rosetta Stone. He was required, therefore, to depend upon the fables of the Greeks and, to a degree, the fabulous histories of the Romans for any knowledge that he might possess of Egypt. Yet very near the time we mention, the Rosetta Stone was discovered, and with it, the modern Egyptologist opened 5,000 years of classical Egyptian history. Now, this opening had more value than might seem at first. The decoding of the glyphs by Champollion was a fascinating, dramatic episode. Yet it also had a long-range effect upon our thinking. Out of the past, for example, emerged a great culture, a culture with a strange, long history of its own, a culture which in many episodes paralleled our own, a culture which, like an ancestor, which had lived before us, experienced most of the things which we experience, passed through numerous trials and tribulations, set in motion causes which could only produce inevitable results. Thus, Egypt emerged as a great object lesson in terms of history, in terms of culture, religion, philosophy. And we suddenly crossed this long interval of the unknown and found the ancient Egyptian to be a human being like ourselves, and not merely a shadow cast by a few fragments of Greek and Roman literature. The same thing occurred in the development of our knowledge of Near Eastern archaeology. About the year 1800, the church historian, the religious thinker in the world of history, suddenly shifted his perspective. He no longer depended upon Josephus and Eusebius. He no longer attempted to write history by rewriting previous history. He became aware of archaeology. He became aware of the possibility of excavating within the regions of his interests, bringing to light lost records, lost objects, lost artifacts, by which, again, he was able to humanize the antiquity with which he was concerned. We may therefore note a broad development of archaeological research with its effect upon history, and the shifting of it from rumor and tradition to revealed and established fact. This was important because it helped the 19th century man to orient himself. He suddenly realized that he did not stand at a summit of an exclusive and isolated culture. He realized that behind him was wave after wave of integrated, orderly, historical motion, that many nations had risen and fallen before his time, and that in a way he was heir to them all. This approach to history solved many mysteries and riddles, and caused us to begin to realize that arts and sciences did not spring into existence full-grown, like Minerva from the head of Zeus, but had gradually and painfully evolved over long periods of time. This emphasis began to establish the historical importance of the law of evolution. It also began to strengthen in man's thinking the importance of tracing his own origin. He began to conceive no longer 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years of human existence, but pressed back the boundaries of man's life, coming to figures exceeding 1 million or 10 million years. He began to have more and more proof of things which had previously seemed strange, unbelievable, and mysterious. All of this certainly affected our way of life. In these researches also, a more critical attitude was turned toward the achievements of the past. And in this critical attitude, man came upon a number of interesting and important facts still useful to him. He began to take a systematic study, for example, of Roman law, and discovered that the Romans, in many respects, were better legislators than 19th century English and American judges and lawyers. He began to recognize the importance of man's experiment with the mystery of government. He observed now 5,000 years of administrative policies. He could see why some succeeded and others failed. He could observe the common traps into which most had fallen. He was able to contemplate the extreme measures and emergency processes which men of the past had set up and which brought a variety of consequences, some good and some bad. Thus, a new perspective was given, not only in this field, but to medicine, to science in general, to mathematics, to art, music, literature. There was just a great opening, and the foundations that had been laid in the 17th and 18th centuries for the liberalizing of the human mind began to prove valuable. Men began to appreciate, as they had not before, the works of the certain link thinkers, particularly men of the caliber of Bacon and Descartes. These recognitions led also to a better understanding of the world that had suddenly emerged into the thinking of men such as Voltaire, Rousseau, Thomas Paine, and our own American Benjamin Franklin. Thus, by degrees, provincialism broke down. Also, the isolationism which man had placed around his then existing culture. Men had thought of the 19th century and of the 18th, the 17th, as islands upon the surface of barbarism, that they were surrounded by a sea of ignorance. Suddenly, men began to realize that they lived not on islands, but on great continents, intellectual continents, and that these continents sustained a variety of interesting and important knowledge and understanding. All these things led the way to what we might term the opening of the modern world as we know it, a world in which the individual was able to take new ideas without shock or stress to his personality, in which he no longer thought merely of his own culture, but of world culture, and also in which he had the courage to begin to fit man into a place in the plan, rather than to assume the plans devised solely for the benefit of man. To a degree, this may have seemed a bit humiliating to the human being who had regarded himself as unique. But with the coming of the 19th century, the unique man disappeared. And in his place arose a pattern of process, of procedure, of evolution, unfoldment, of gradual integration, and of the converging of innumerable streams of light to make possible the kind of world which we live in today. With it came some broadening appreciation also of the valuable contributions of distant areas, such as Asia, the Near East, North Africa, etc. Now, this 19th century also brought with it, as one might suspect, the kind of extreme attitude with which change is nearly always marked. There is a certain fanaticism about change. Things happen rapidly before man is able to digest them. The leader may exceed his own reasonable boundaries. He may try to force his conclusions beyond their facts. A good example of that can also be found in the 20th century, in which the rise, for example, of psychological thinking has caused a kind of unbalance in our philosophical life. Psychology became a cure-all, a solution to everything, a tremendous discovery which men did not evaluate correctly. They simply accepted or rejected empirically. And as a result, this situation rather got out of hand. In the 19th century, progress was out of hand. The individual had not yet matured and mellowed his perspective. All these new and wonderful things that came to his attention confused him, filled him with a certain optimism, but did not give him the instruments of discrimination and discernment. These had to come gradually as a result of experiencing the unhappy consequences of his own position. About this time also, another stream of problem was beginning to develop. This had developed from the pressures of the Reformation. The Reformation was the exchange of one orthodoxy for another. It was man's intellectual liberation from the hierarchy of the Roman Church to fall under a kind of bondage or slavery to a strange kind of rebellious stubbornness. The Puritan was a man of devout mind and of good intention, we do not doubt, but he was extremely narrow in his thinking. His attitude was so completely, literally bound up with the jots and tittles of the Scripture, and dominated also by a kind of antagonism against anyone that differed from himself. This kind of pressure had a very depressing effect upon the spiritual life of the individual. The Reformation, bringing as it did a strong emphasis upon Protestantism, led inevitably to a rebellion within the human being. And this rebellion manifested itself in the early 19th century as the rise of Protestant mysticism. Protestant mysticism being man's escape again, this time from a literal acceptance of doctrines. This escape was pressed to a further degree by the rising structure of man's technical knowledge. Archaeology was discovering facts. These facts had to be fitted into theological concepts which had not been prepared to accept them. The world changed its pattern. The opening chapters of Genesis became less digestible in a literal form. Men loved their religious writings, however, venerated them, and wished to preserve them. The only answer seemed to be to enlarge their interpretation. So we find groups arising such as the New England Transcendentalists, under the leadership of such men as Thoreau and Emerson. These individuals were fighting for the restoration of the beauty of a mystical religion, a mystical philosophy of life, a philosophy which was strong in idealistic overtones and yet was broad and deep enough to accept the discoveries of an ever-increasingly strong scientific body. Thus we have, at this time in America, the rise of our first important school of letters. We find scholarship stretching out far into the hinterland for inspiration. Examination of Emerson's library is now partly possible because the old Massachusetts library which he used fortunately kept records of the books which were loaned to various persons. The books selected by Emerson have now become an important list. These books included not only the best European writers, but the best translations of the Greek scholars, especially those translations made by Thomas Taylor, outstanding works such as Stanley's History of Philosophy, and the early available issues of Oriental classics, particularly the first English edition of the Bhagavad Gita. These books were all used by Emerson, and as a result, we begin to see why he came to be regarded as a geographical misfit, and why many people felt that he should have been born in a classical cultural group rather than in a rather square-toed puritanical New England. But this break presented itself in a number of other forms, meaning in the early years of the 19th century that we had quite a revival of religious interests, many of them centering in the eastern part of the United States, but spreading out. The New England Transcendentalists undoubtedly contributed to many of the liberal religious organizations that we know today. They made possible the rise of what we term modern, popular, metaphysical thinking. They also contributed as much as they could to a powerful idealism, although this has become generally obscured outside of the religious field. We also find rising at this time movements that were to profoundly affect our religious thinking, such as spiritualism, which also arose in New England, Christian Science, and of course Mormonism, which came into existence at no great distance from the other groups. All these movements represented a kind of revolt, partly inspired by the impossibility of making the older theological interpretations agree with the rising body of scientific knowledge. Man, determined to preserve his religious conviction, found it necessary to grow and to enlarge his understanding of the spiritual values which were important to him. There was at this time also a strong rise of interest in St. Paul, and his mystical concept of Christianity became really the central focus of the transcendentalist movements arising in the United States. These were all movements that had to do with the concept of liberation, but perhaps in another department this activity is more obvious and better recorded historically. Around the year 1800, we find the beginning of what we term the era of revolutions. Revolutions, in this case, gather around this focal year. Some were somewhat earlier, others were to follow shortly after. But in the period between around 1750 and 1850, we had most of the basic revolutionary movements working themselves out on the political level. We know, for example, that the first important pronouncements of Karl Marx came into existence about 1840. that these had exercised at their time only a limited influence, but gradually intensified to form a positive basis for what was then known as socialism. Socialism being a movement of liberation on the political level. Around this same time, we see the results of the French Revolution, the reign of terror, and the rise of the Napoleonic Empire. We have, therefore, at this time, a vast war pattern which almost parallels the 12th century conquest of Genghis Khan. Also at this time, we find the breaking away of colonial America, particularly from Spain. And we see the rise of a number of heroes and heroic personalities in the Latin area. Between 1800 and around 1840 or 50, thus we find coming some of the more important names that we associate with the rise of democracy in the West. In Mexico, Miguel Hidalgo, the liberator. One of the most powerful men of his time, although his own achievements were not marked with any great success, he formed a breach, or made a breach and a wall through which others were to pass later. At this time also we find Simón Bolívar, the liberator of Latin America in general, at least one of the most venerated names in the area, making his famous oath of Rome, that he was going to liberate his people from ignorance, superstition, and fear. He accomplished a great deal, was neglected, ignored, and very largely misused by those he had served so well, and it is said that he ended his career penniless, dying in a bed given to him by a friend in a borrowed nightshirt. The bed and Bolívar had the nightshirt, not the friend. Anyway, the situation goes on. We find Benito Juarez appearing about this period and gradually developing the campaign which was to change again a large part of the history of the Latin American area. Thus, all through this early time, we see men struggling for liberation. We find also in this struggle the gradual liberating of slaves. We observe laws passed in one country after another, by means of which the freedom of the human being became more and more a concern of the public mind. In the earlier part of this period, we find the rise of the little Republic of Liberia, which was the beginning of Negro emancipation from the United States. And the cycle terminates, of course, with the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Other nations, however, had also passed into this cycle of liberation. And one by one, these countries dissolved the laws by which slavery was possible and also by which imprisonment for debt was possible. These changes affected the political life of the world. They affected the estates of persons. And there were other important moves also made. Up to about the year 1800 and even a little later than that, education was very largely under the influence of religion. Up to the time we mentioned, nearly all the chairs of the Doctors of Philosophy in our great schools were held by Doctors of Divinity, producing what has been called the cycle of the Scottish metaphysicians. The schools were very largely dominated by religious thinking on the level of philosophy and psychology. We see this beginning to break down and find the rise of the Doctor of Philosophy in his own right, without dependence upon theology or religion. This was almost inevitable in view of the situation that was gradually building up to the final discoveries and pronouncements of the Darwinian theory. Thus, the world was in transition. Intellectually, it was moving very rapidly. Physically, it had not yet changed to any appreciable degree, but the causes of change were beginning to become evident everywhere. Even as early as the year 1800, or shortly thereafter, we also observe another interesting economic situation, which called for a lot of reorganization of human policy. Although we had not yet entered into an industrial era, what we termed business was beginning to loom large on the horizon. Business at that time was conducted in small offices by underpaid clerks who spent most of their time writing letters in beautiful Spencerian hands for their comparatively illiterate proprietors. It was not a particularly encouraging period. Good wages at that time in England were £12 a year for a good clerk. And perhaps some of these abuses are shown in Dickens' writings, especially his Christmas Carol. The situation, however, was that merchants were reaching out in all directions. The sea had become a more or less open area. Trade with various countries became more and more imperative to take care of the rising levels of life at home. It was becoming necessary to export goods, and it was also becoming increasingly important to import raw materials. As early, therefore, as 1790, we begin to see strong agitations involving the establishment of powerful trading units. Some of these trading units had already been rather effective, but heavy strain was put upon them. We had groups such as the Hudson's Bay Company, the East India Company, the China Company, and other groups working to create markets for European goods in Asia, and also seeking concessions in the East by means of which they would be able to secure further materials with which to advance the industrial state of labor in their respective countries. This ran against considerable opposition, as might be expected, and early in the century this opposition locked itself around the history of China, which therefore becomes intriguing to us. China at that time was under the comparatively new Manchu dynasty. The Manchurians had more or less taken over, had established themselves strongly in Peking, and had also become strongly Chinese. Now, in those days, China's policy was a very simple one in international relationships. It was extremely simple, inasmuch as China recognized only the Chinese and slaves or servants. The non-Chinese world consisted of barbarians, not worthy of any consideration whatsoever, and not upon a psychological level which justified any treaties with them or any efforts to attain economic parity. Time after time, delegates were sent with full documentation and with very bulging portfolios to China to try to negotiate treaties. The Chinese consistently regarded these diplomats as merely merchants, refused to meet them, sent only their servants to consult with them, and paid no attention whatever to their demands. China's exclusiveness led to considerable controversy, and in the course of this controversy, bad feeling passed from bad to worse, and finally resulted in a series of minor wars and outbreaks, the purpose being very largely to establish treaties with China. China was for some reason a very central factor in these negotiations. Gradually these treaties began to take form, and ultimately Europe and America, behind treaties, moved into Asia. This was important. The entry of the English into China, the entry later of the French, then the Dutch, then the United States, and several other countries, meant not only an exchange of merchandise, but an exchange of ideas. This is notable in passing in its effect upon the ceramic industry of England. For about this time, or shortly thereafter, a large part of English dinnerware was ornamented with Chinese paintings, carefully copied from things like the famous Chinese blue plate design and other similar patterns. The pattern also moved into France, which had a practical epidemic of neo-Chinese artistry, going so far as to affect the costumes of the court and of the and the artistry of the various schools of design, such as fabrics, upholstery, and furniture even architecture. Then, of course, we find the peculiar situation such as the Chinese Chippendale, in which the furniture makers began to copy Chinese furniture. All of this carried with it still further overtones. We could not deal with these people. We could not import the beautiful things which they made, and we could not reject them as customers without finally becoming a little more aware of them as persons. Let us say that at the turn of the century, around the year 1800, the European population of China was about 90% missionaries. These missionaries were having a more or less troublesome time of it, and about the year 1800, it is estimated they had managed to make about 150,000 Christian converts in China out of a population of 300 or 350 million. They were not getting along too well. In fact, at that time, the death rate was overtaking them. Behind these missionaries came a few merchants. The missionaries, because of tradition, Christian missionaries had been visiting China since the second century. Because of tradition, these missionaries were reasonably well treated, and with the exception of an occasional interlude, were left much in peace. But to bring anything else in was extremely difficult, and it was some years before a string of treaty ports were finally established. The Chinese had their side to this also, however, because one of the great difficulties in the early half of the 19th century was the introduction of opium into China from Europe. The Chinese resented this very strongly and quite rightfully, and the opium wars and things of that nature rather disfigured Europe's place in Chinese history. Gradually, however, through treaties, this situation was largely remedied, but never entirely so. This meant another extending of boundaries and of motions away from the old patterns of things, the establishment of more intimate contact with the older world, an older culture, and through the Honorable East India Company, the same thing was happening largely in India. Thus, we have a new picture here. From the ancient classical times and the gradual infiltration of culture from Asia into Europe, a cultural infiltration which extended from about the 10th century BC down well into the medieval period in European history, we suddenly had a reverse. Now we had Europe and America infiltrating into Asia, carrying into Asia manufactured goods, carrying into the Far East the products of Western ingenuity, and perhaps most of all the advantages of Western methodology and Western science. This stream continued to increase until it really became quite common. By the middle of the century also, we see the opening of Japan. The opening of Japan is a sufficiently interesting episode for us to give as little attention to it. For some time, the United States and other powers have been attempting to negotiate an important treaty with the Mikado of Japan. All efforts have failed because the Mikado could not be reached. The Mikado at that time was residing quietly in Kyoto, which was the old cultural center of Japan, and the government was in the hands of the great Tokugawa shogunate. Now, the Tokugawa shoguns were the military dictators of Japan and belonged to a descent of families which had held this position for a very long time, perhaps even as early as the 12th century under Yoritomo. This dictatorship left the Mikado as spiritual head of the empire, but all material and practical concerns were in the hands of these dictator princes, these great daimyos that formed a sort of military political council under the shogun. When Geary finally was able to reach Japan, he was only able to present his credentials to the shogun. He never did reach the Mikado, although for some time it was believed that he had. Gradually, however, the effect of the entry of Geary's fleet and the psychological consequence of this contact with the West began to bear fruit. The only previous contact of importance had been that of St. Francis Xavier, who had created a missionary colony in the province of Satsuma. And the moment it became obvious that the West and East must meet, Japan prepared for the blow. How Japan suddenly qualified for entrance into the Western family of nations is not entirely known to us, because so much of their history at this time remains as yet untranslated into English. But one thing is certain. Japan has woke to the realization that it must join the other powers as a united nation, that it must have a sovereignty vested in a person or in some recognized and generally revered leader. Up to that time, Japan had been in a state of feudalism, very similar to that of Europe in the 14th and 15th centuries. This could not be possible if it was to enter into contact with more highly organized political entities. After due deliberation and consideration, therefore, the last of the Tokugawa shoguns, the military dictator, presented his credentials to the emperor and resigned, returning all of his powers to the crown. This was done voluntarily, which is an unusual episode in anybody's history, that a family that had been in power probably for 600 years, or a descent of families, should voluntarily relinquish all of that power for the good of the nation. This the shogun did, however, and the Mikado emerged as both spiritual and temporal leader of Japan. From that time on, the history of Japan shows the increasing influence of Western culture, Western industrialism, Western progress, as we like to call it. And by the end of the 19th century, Japan was a recognized world power. This is another example of the impact which brought about a marked change in the psychology of international relationships. One other point might be made, however, to show that the Japanese dies hard. I remember that when I was in Japan, about the time of the great earthquake in Tokyo, the first taxi cabs had been introduced. A group of them had been taken off of a ship and were standing on the docks waiting to be put into use. The Japanese rickshaw men, forming a very quiet but powerful union of their own, went quietly down to the dock and dumped them all into the ocean because of the inevitable disastrous result of such conveyances in the economy of Japan. Now, however, we are informed that the rickshaw is almost extinct and is only to be found as an occasional novelty for the benefit of tourists, like some of the old horse-drawn carriages that you can still see parked at the south end of Central Park in New York waiting for a stray customer. Japan did not move too quickly, but a gradual process of modernization was noted throughout its entire structure. Now we go to one of the more important phases of this, which is all moving in one direction, whether we realize it or not. And we have to study a little bit the application of history to the thinking of the early 19th century, as this bears upon the present state of man. The United States, France, had established a democratic government. The government of the United States maintained its democracy, or its republican form of democracy, without any great mishap, although it had a number of very close shaves. On the other hand, the French did not do so well. They were not apparently of one mind in the matter of democracy. They had achieved their freedom against the autocracy of the Bourbon at a tremendous cost and with an extraordinary fanaticism that was bound to leave a great many scars. Thus France fell out of monarchy into democracy, and promptly fell out of democracy into imperialism with the rise of the Napoleonic era. From that time on, for a long while, the democracy as a functioning entity in France had numerous setbacks. The idea did not sit as well in Europe as it did in America. The psychological conditioning was entirely different, and there was evidently too much bad history in the background to permit the experiment to proceed in a reasonable way. But with this change in the political state of two important nations, and with the coming of a new attitude toward knowledge, we begin to see a development of sciences, a development of exact thinking, with a corresponding decline in what might be termed essential culture. The 19th century shows a very serious decadence in culture and a tremendous rise in man's intellectual productivity. The 19th century is remembered to us very largely for the rather cramped and stuffy mid-Victorianism, in which probably nearly every important art and creative expression went under eclipse. It was a bad period in painting, a very poor period in architecture, a miserable period in stylization, and it produced very little in the creative fields of art, except in Europe, where there was a tremendous renaissance of music. But with the exception of music, nearly all forms of art suffered seriously. This is interesting in comparison to our present situation, where we are again diving into an era of intensive scientific research and progress. Here again, practically the only art that is surviving and is actually flourishing is music. Nearly all other arts are being heavily penalized. It is probable that music has survived this period and also survived the 19th century period because of its non-intellectual reaction upon the individual. Music does not interfere with the Darwinian theory or the Mendelian law. Music does not get locked into a conflict over the Newtonian hypothesis. Music is not involved in the present problem of interspace travel. The music, because of its almost total emotional impact upon the listener, is something which is compatible with nearly every other interest or activity of the human mind and forms a very important escape mechanism under periods of great intellectual stress. I think this is also evident in the fact that the technical composer, who is a great musicologist in his own right, is not frequently found in a mechanistic group. It is still to be found more in the European group, particularly the Slavic. But where we have a strong emotional frustration, music seemingly occupies a prominent position. The 20th century science has locked itself with idealism in a more or less continuing struggle. 19th century scientific footings were assailed by the then existing theological systems pretty strongly. There was quite a religious science battle going on at that time. Unfortunately, the armament was rather unequal. Science was coming forward with facts that were difficult to disprove, and theology was unable to cope with these facts. It was one of the examples of a situation about which we should be most thoughtful. Namely, we do religion an ill turn when we so interpret it that it can come into conflict with progress. One of the things that's important in religion, as the Indian philosophers found out long ago, was that the religious conviction must be kind of open toward the future, so that new discoveries will not discredit religious convictions, but rather will only help to sustain them and float them forward. A good example of this was the impact of Westernism upon Japan and its dominant faith, which is Buddhism. As far as we can learn from historical records, the modernizing of Japan did not cause a moment's ruffle in the development of the Buddhistic faith in that country. There was never a time in which a Buddhist priest or anyone of that kind thundered against progress. There was never a time when modern scientific methodology or modern scientific concepts came into a head-on collision with a Buddhist doctrine. The reason being that Buddhism was very astute in not establishing any boundaries upon the human consciousness. Anything that man discovered, anything that he realized, anything that he was able to demonstrate in a laboratory was, as far as the Orient was concerned, good Buddhism, because there was nothing in the doctrine by means of which a heretic on the scientific level could be conceived possible. There was therefore comparative freedom from this rather unhappy situation. The year of liberation also began with a series of rather simple movements beginning in the lives of people. One thing that everyone has always wanted to be liberated from was taxation. And of course we can begin to appreciate today just exactly what that would mean. In fact, I saw a document not long ago being advanced by someone, hoping that it would catch the public opinion, stating that that his idea of a good political party would be one that abolished all federal and state and city taxes. Now, he unfortunately forgot to tell us how these communities and the nation were to be supported otherwise, but at the same time, he undoubtedly will gather a number of strong adherents to the concept. Taxation, while it was only a shadow of what we know today, was of concern in the early 19th century. The individual was beginning to enter into a new economic era. What we call today the average man began to have money in his pocket. Now this will change any system of economy anywhere on earth. The old time of barter and exchange was fading out of our mind. Of course, even in the early half of the 19th century, the average physician was paid in eggs or whatever they happened to have. But gradually, cash was beginning to emerge. This meant, with it, a rising tide of rebellion against such social barriers as had previously divided class groups, both in the United States and England, to a lesser degree on the continent, but certainly in these two areas, prominently. The man with money in his pocket suddenly began to realize that he was a potential aristocrat. He also came to the final conclusion that a person who has no money in his pocket is also a potential socialist. And being of this mind and not having anything was very enthusiastic in dividing it with other people. We learned one lesson. Those who have wanted to keep. Those who did not have wanted everyone else to share. This led to some intriguing political developments in this period of time. But while many of them, such as the populist movement and similar groups, did not exactly accomplish their goal or achieve anything in particular, they did leave a heritage of speculation. A heritage which later supported the single tax idea and now apparently is inspiring the no tax idea. This social growth, however, literally meant that human beings were beginning to accumulate things. While they had nothing, there was nothing to tax. But when they began to have things, when land began to be more valuable, when cities began to grow, when produce and construction procedures were under greater demand, the possibility of raising standards of living and of gradually integrating what we would term today the great middle class, these dreams took visualization and a great deal of form. So in this period also, we begin to see the rise of labor organizations, the beginning of man's effort to participate in the profits of production, and of course the great slogan of early socialism, production for use instead of for profit. These things were coming. All of these procedures increased in many ways the costs and responsibilities of government. And it has been pointed out again and again that the political situation in the United States in the first half of the 19th century was extremely a caricature, a kind of cartoon of things that were to come. It showed in a small way many problems that we now must face in a much larger and more general manner. Also about this time, we began to recognize that in spite of all of our thinking, that the Western Hemisphere was not a really isolated area of land. Gradually, our dependence upon other peoples began to emerge. And while this did not really take much shape until the 20th century, still the rudiments were there. We were beginning to reach out. We were also beginning to travel more. I was reading some letters not long ago, written in 1827, by a young man who had decided to seek fame and fortune by going west. He had left a little town in New Jersey, and he said in his letter, "I am going out into the wilderness. I am going west into an unknown land. I'm headed for Detroit." Now, it's hard for us to realize this situation. But that was the way it was. It was a frightful trip in those days. We have several of his letters, including a terrible storm on the Great Lakes and an almost impossible situation in Detroit, including a terrible pestilence that was almost destroying the community. It was a rugged time, but it also gave vent to something that was important. It gave release to the first dangers of over-centralization. Cities and towns were beginning to take definite shape along our Atlantic seaboard. Competition between men was increasing. There was no adequate distribution of goods. The transportation facilities were so poor that a great many goods could not even be shipped. Therefore, in local areas, life was becoming stifling. And so in this period also, while Peary was sailing the seas and while the English were opening their treaty ports at Amoy and Wuhu and Wei Hai Wei and several of these choice Chinese names, the American was going west. He was breaking through the Cumberland Gap. He was going further and further into the unknown to hew out a new way of life. Discontent always moved west, just as previous discontent moving west had left Europe and come to this country. This westward motion, as advocated by Horace Greeley, was factual and a tremendous release for steam. People had the sense of adventure still strong within them, and they found it desirable and satisfying to open up new territory and establish themselves in new farms and communities. Thus, what might have become much earlier a social revolution was worked off in migration, in the adventure of a larger boundary for living. You know, it's interesting that even in this we have a certain parallel with our present problem. We have just about exhausted the possibility of migration. Nearly every square foot of earth that we can do much of anything with is already claimed by somebody. And while the poles may still be available, the limitations as yet upon the desirability of the areas is rather discouraging. So what do? It looks as though we're heading for other planets. We're looking for other worlds to conquer. It seemingly is part of a psychological pressure within man to break through any limitation that becomes difficult. And the escape from repression, from frustration, pushed the 19th century man west. Here he worked it out or simply fell a victim to the procedure and was not heard of again. This situation carried with it a powerful motion of the proletariat group, and the intellectual group was moving in behind, working to solve problems bearing upon these difficulties. Science was beginning to produce the beginnings of relief. For instance, in the development of transportation, it was not long before the markets of the world were vastly enlarged. Also, in communication, distant places were tied more and more closely together. The development of powerful improvement in utility systems made it possible for larger communities to exist. The need for feeding the city began to take on practical consideration. And in all of these elements, history stepped in. Because these changes were not made simply by dreamers depending upon their own imagination alone. Each of the steps that was taken, by means of which the 19th century emerged from an agricultural or agrarian foundation to an industrial one, each of these steps was based upon a careful consideration of the preceding 5,000 years of history. Without that history, these achievements could not have been possible. The early planning of American cities from the standpoint of sanitation was based upon the restoration of the patterns and plans set up by Vitruvius to make possible the metropolitan city of Rome. It was necessary to create vast systems of sewers and aqueducts to supply cities. Our early American communities had no knowledge of this.